You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. Good afternoon. This is Dori Francis. I am your host of Every Voice Matters here every week, 11 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Mountain, 1 Central, and 2 East. So today we're covering all bases, and I want to thank you for being here today. I have a great guest here today who has been on a 30-year journey and mission, Trace Embry, who is the co-founder of Shepherd's Hill Academy and is also the host of the Licensed Parent Radio program. And if you haven't listened to his program, I want to make sure that you get that information because he really shares a lot on a pretty regular basis. Hi, Trace. Nice to see you.
Hi, Dori. Nice to see you. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. I just really want to take the opportunity for people to get to know a little bit more about you and your journey and how Shepherd's Hill started. I know that it's quite an interesting story. And just before we came on air, you mentioned you're actually going to be having a book coming out before the end of the year. So we'll need to hear about that as well and talking about, you know, your journey. But let's start off with just sharing a little bit more about you before Shepherd's Hill and what life was like for you before you came here.
Well, I was born and raised in the Chicago area. I grew up in two dysfunctional homes. My parents were divorced when I was 5 years old. And so I had the privilege of seeing two different dysfunctional families on both ends of the continuum and found a happy medium in there somewhere. And I grew up in the 70s and 80s out of high school. I bought that cultural lie, that you know, that narcissistic tendency in me to he who dies with the most toys wins. And so I was going to go out there and, you know, be a millionaire before I was 30. And but before that happened, I had acquired a wife, 3 beautiful kids, a house in the burbs, a couple of businesses. And life was good, you know, or so I thought. I started realizing what, you know, I'm going to do this tomorrow and the next day and the next day after that. And, you know, people back then would still ask you, how are you going to raise your kids? Under what, you know, what parenting paradigm, what model, what religion? And my wife and I had a very limited amount of church background when we were younger, mostly sent to church a few times. But beyond that,
for a lot of us at that time.
Yeah. Because it was ingrained in our culture. And but other than when we were married in 1980, we had not been in church in about 20 years. And I had a buddy, I was a policeman, and along with the businesses, and I left police work to pursue those businesses. But I had a buddy who had gone through a series of heartaches and headaches and misery, actually. I mean, he filed bankruptcy, he lost his wife, lost his father. Lost his home, all in the same, virtually the same month. And every time I saw him, and we were friends since childhood. We were policemen together, and we played all sports together. We got our first jobs at McDonald's together. We were roofers together. I mean, he ended up marrying my wife's cousin. But every time I saw him, he seemed to be on top of the world. And what makes you tick?
Even with all the heartache.
Even with all the heartache, and I got to thinking, you know, I'm living the American dream, and I'm still moaning the blues every now and then about, you know, how much of a struggle things are. And he said, it's Jesus Christ. And he said that plainly. And we had our Jesus talks, you know, when we were kids, you know, that they left as soon as they started. But this was a different deal. This is a different level. This was a man now, serious about his pursuit of the deeper things of life. And he invited me to church. And when I came to church, I took my wife and kids, and Beth looked at me and I looked at her, because they had an interim pastor at the time. He wasn't the regular pastor. The regular pastor had left, a new pastor was coming in. And I looked at her and I said, "We ain't coming back here. There's no way. This is insanity. This is nuts." And my friend begged me to come back. He says, "When the real next pastor, the real pastor comes in, he's coming in next week. Just give it another shot." And I did. And there was something that was delivered in that message that really resonated with me as far as something true and real and genuine. And same thing with my wife. And it was on from there. It was we really entered into a deeper walk with God, to where, as opposed to just knowing the Ten Commandments, you're not supposed to kill anybody. You're not supposed to steal or, commit adultery or stuff like that, lie. We knew that stuff. But when we started hearing the specific things of God, as we developed a deeper relationship with him by opening up his written word, what we call the Bible, prayer time, interaction with other people who were pursuing the face of God as well, we started hearing some things. And one of the things that we heard was, believe it or not, and it made no sense whatsoever, leave your business.
Oh.
And I'm like, what is that all about? And then my wife and I had these, bedtime discussions about, after a few years of, being involved in church, I think God is telling us that he wants to use us in ministry. And she says, "That's crazy. I'm thinking the same thing." And it was just so crazy, because we wrestled with this for about a year. And after about a year, oh my gosh. When you're making your living by what you do. And actually, I was the original Uber. We had a program that took drunks home from bars and restaurants.
You were the original Uber.
and we had contracted with almost 300 bars and restaurants in the Chicago area. And even our pastor said, "Trace, what you're doing is not sinful. You're helping." I left the police department to do this because I'd scraped up a bunch of bodies off the highway because of drunk driving. And he says, "But you have to listen to that still small voice." And I did, and I did, and I did. And it was about a year after that when I got a phone call random from that pastor. He said, "Trace, have you considered Bible college? I really think God wants." And I never told him that we were getting that tap on the shoulder. And after a series of events, and I could go, it's all in the book, it was undeniable that God wanted to use us in ministry. And we were just two of the most unlikely candidates. I'd raced cars all my life. I was an auto racer for 40 years.
I think sometimes, when we get those messages, Trace, we kind of put ourselves in a box and say, "Oh, but I don't fit that," without really looking at the whole heart of the whole person, not just what you're doing.
Or how about the people that God has used in the past, according to scripture? I mean, Moses didn't consider himself, someone who he would use for ministry. I mean, pardon the way I say this, but if God could use a jackass to rebuke a true prophet of God, Balaam, he can certainly use one like me, right? And I fought it the whole way, but I finally came to terms with it. And the vice president of our company said, "Here, take this magazine." It was a Moody monthly magazine, and we looked in it, and there was an advertisement for a place called Tocoa Falls College in Georgia. And my pastor sent us to his college in Springfield, Missouri. Beth and I took that trip, and it was like, "No, man, it's a great school, but
that's not it, huh?"
Not it. And when we went to TFC, it was just like, "We're not even praying about this." It's like all the way home, our prayer was, "Lord, just, take care of the lights and gas, sell the house for us." We just knew that we knew that we knew that we knew. And then when you got another human being who has the same feelings about this, it's a lot of confirmation. Well, we had a 700-mile trip. We were invited to a concert on a Saturday for Saturday night, but we decided to leave Saturday morning because we wanted to get back to church in the Chicago area for Sunday morning. And the concert that we basically blew off ended up coming back to haunt us a little bit, because we got in about 9 o'clock Saturday night from Georgia, where we were looking at Tocoa Falls College. And it was someone from our church that had never asked me to do this in all the time we had gone. He said, "We have a music minister that needs to be picked up at O'Hare Airport," which is about 70 miles from where I lived. He says, "Are you available to do that?" I said, "Well, I just traveled 700." I said, "Sure, I'll do it." So I got up early, went up there, picked him up, and it was a guy named Randy Matthews. And I don't know how popular Randy Matthews is now. I couldn't have picked him out of a line even then. But I asked him, I said, "So where are you coming from?" And he says, "Oh, you would never hear of it. And I said, "Well, just try me." He says, "Forget it. I said, "Well, please just tell me where you're coming from." He said, "Some little bitty school, college down in Georgia." I said, "Seriously, where?" He said, "It's Cole Falls College." I said, "I'm glad I pursued that." I said, "Because I was there 24 hours ago, and I was invited to your concert last night, and I decided to come here." He says, "Well, I guess you got, I've been praying for confirmation all the way back from Georgia." So he says, "I guess you got it." Well, there's a number of things like that took place over the next couple of years that Beth and I, we're hard-headed, slow learners. And Beth is my wife. And yet it confirmed to us that Tocoa Falls College was where we're supposed to go. And so eventually in August of 1991, I was a 34-year-old Bible college freshman with three kids. And we didn't know a soul.
And we bought a step, moved the whole family.
Whole family left the house empty. We gave away what we couldn't sell, sold what we could. And we didn't have a job lined up. We had nothing. It was just 100% faith. And by the way, lest you think that it's blind faith, I'm a firm believer, and I was even at that time. Faith, that kind of faith is not blind faith. Faith is acting on what we have a reason to believe is true. So it's not blind faith. I had plenty of reasons, and I'd be here the rest of the program sharing with you those things. But long and short of it is we ended up there, and God just blessed that whole time. And when you first go to Bible college, you think, well, you're going to be a missionary or a pastor or something like that. And we were prepared to do whatever he was calling us to do. We did not know. All we knew was,
So you just kind of stepped into it and was waiting for it to unfold to see what was getting your way.
Exactly. Yeah. Because if you read My Utmost for His Highest, Oswald Chambers, he says, obey the light God gives you, and then he'll give you more light. So as you obey, he open and walk through the doors that he's presented before you, then more doors come open. And if you look at scripture, that's how it works.
Oh, Abraham, absolutely. I'm a firm believer in that. I've experienced that myself.
Yes.
Going through something like that right now as well. Major change. Yep.
Yeah. Well, Abraham left the old country not knowing where he was going.
Right.
And Moses, a very similar thing. He just knew there was a place to go, and you start by starting. And we did that, and it made no sense. My family was mad at me. My best parents.
I'm sure.
You're going there just to have an easier life. And I'm like, what? Easier life? And I heard all those things. Mm. And about midway through our Bible college experience, we got the tap on the shoulder again from the Lord.
Did Beth go to Bible college as well?
She's part-time.
Part-time.
But she had a full-time job. She got a full-time job once we got there, working in the cafeteria, the school cafeteria, for just over minimum wage.
Oh, wow.
And I took a minimum wage job in the workshop just because I felt like too guilty to be full-time while she's working, and we're trying to be good parents all at the same time and pay our way through Bible college.
Right.
We did have a little bit of money tucked away because as we were loading up our rider truck, our 12-man crew of a roofing company that I had said, "Look, we got plenty of work. Can we buy the roofing company from you?"
Oh,
I said,
wow.
"Well, sure." Well, so we had a monthly check from that, but that dried up pretty soon because they were roofers and not business people, so they started driving around in big chrome wheeled trucks, and they thought they were, they'd arrived, and they ran it into the ground is what happened.
Oh.
But later on, I realized that there were still people that needed roofs in their house, still knew that I would do it part time. And I was making more money doing one roof job than a month and a half working in that shop.
Okay.
And that worked out real well going to school. So I would make these suicide missions from Georgia, 700 miles to Northwest Indiana. And I'd be roofing house, bring that money back where it went three times as far in Georgia. And that helped get us through 3 years of Bible college while we were paying our bill at the same time. But when we realized that that God was wanting us to acquire land, and that was the thing, he said, you're not going to be a pastor in the traditional sense. We heard no audible voice, but this is what was spoken to our hearts. You need land, start looking for it. And so every weekend we would pack up the kids in the minivan and we would, you know, drive around the highways and byways of Northeast Georgia. And the very first place we ran into, which was 14 miles from Tocoa Falls College, was this old abandoned rundown farm. And it wasn't for sale. We knocked on doors and said, people would tell us no one will ever get that place. It's all tied up in the legal system. And the reason it was tied up in the legal system is because it was an old drug operation. They were doing aerial drops in the pastures. And,
oh, my goodness.
And there was a triple murder involved in it. So it was kind of deeded over to into a trust of a 11 or 12-year-old kid. So it was going to be a while before it came available. But so the next year and a half, we just kept looking at different places. But we would always come back to
that same place.
What is now Shepherd's Hill Academy.
Okay.
And we would go out in what's called Shepherd's Hill, and we would overlook the Blue Ridge Mountains to the north. There's just a beautiful view out there. And Beth and I would say, you know, man, we can really do something with this. I don't know what, but we're going to do something with this. And so about once a month for the next year and a half, we would go out there and pray as a family. We'd picnic out there. Basically, trespassing is what we were doing.
Well, nobody seemed to care.
No one seemed to care. It was so remote. And the only thing that was out there were cows. And they would come up to us, you know, while we had our blanket down there under a cedar tree. And then a year and a half later, we were on our way to look at maybe the 30th property that we to look at, none of which even remotely felt right. And we passed the road that Shepherd's Hill Academy was on, and there was a magic marker sign that said, for sale by owner, with an arrow pointing down our road. And I looked at Beth, and she looked at me, and it's like, you think that it could be that property? And so we turned around, and sure enough, there was a sign for sale by owner on the property that we've been visiting for a year and a half. And praying, fervently, Lord, if this is you, then you're going to make this happen. Well, by this time, we're flat broke. We couldn't rub two nickels together. So we called our appointment, said, look, we're going to be late. I went to a phone booth. We had no cell phones back then. This was 1993, late 92. I forget exactly. But the guy says, I just put that sign out there a few minutes ago.
I
said, well, can you meet us out there? He says, yeah, I'm right around the corner. So he came, met us out there. And, you know, we'd been very familiar with the place, or we thought. And I said, listen, can I give you a bad check? I think this is a Friday. I said, can I give you a bad check to hold till Monday? I said, I'm not saying we can buy this property, but I'm just saying, can you hold it until next Friday? This was May. At this time, it's May of 19. No, I'm sorry. It was April of 1994.
So how much was your check for?
$200.
Oh, my goodness.
He laughed in my face. He said, you know what? My partner and I, we do business on a handshake, too. He says, I'll hold it, you know, for you. And you come back here next Friday. So that was the week of finals. We were going through finals at school. So I had no time to really get creative. I'd talk to people about it, but, you know, it was the standard. We'll pray for your brother. Oh, that's exciting, you know, right. You know, type of thing. And so we just thought money was going to come, you know, pouring out of the heavens. You know, we were that, you know, presumptuous at that time. Yeah, presumptuous, actually. Although long term it was a confidence, but the timing was wrong. Just like, again, like Moses, you know, he knew he was called, but the timing wasn't quite right. And so we go to this guy's office the following Friday, and he goes, how are you going to do this? And I said, sir, I don't have a clue. And Beth and I were so despondent because that was the last $200 we had, you know, to feed our kids until her next paycheck. And I don't remember exactly how soon that was forthcoming, but we were standing up to leave. And he said, wait a minute. He said, what were you planning to do with that property? And I said, sir, I'm not even sure about that. Something to do with youth. That's all I knew. And we're pretty sure it was something to do with youth. And we were walking out the door, and he says, hold on a minute. Hold on a minute. He says, sit back down. He says, you go down, it's 4 miles into the little town of Livonia. He says, you see a man named Jimmy Malden. You tell him that I said, that I sent you and to give you a loan for that property on price order. At that time, it was a 60-acre farm.
Wow.
And Beth and I were thinking, okay, we'll trust God for 5 acres. And then we realized, no, this is God we're asking. We're just going to go for the whole 60. So I said, who's going to loan me money? And he says, you do what I told you to do. I own that bank. So
we
go down to this bank, meet another guy we never met before in our life named Jimmy. He says, yeah, Tommy said that you were coming. We didn't fill out a loan app. We didn't fill out, a credit app, nothing. He asked us a few questions and said, we'll close Friday. And
wow.
I'm thinking, what in the world? And we walked out the door back to our, and I remember looking across the roof of the minivan at my wife. And I said, what just happened in there? She says, I don't know. We need to get out of here. We thought it was some kind of trick that the Southerners play on the Yankees.
Oh.
We honestly didn't know. It was that foreign to us. And then as we were leaving.
Well, yes, that doesn't happen.
It's insane.
Yeah.
Jimmy comes running out of the bank with a yellow legal pad. And he screams from, not screams, but yells from across the parking lot. Well, I need your last name. And I'm like, Embry. And we got out of there. So it was just so bizarre. And we immediately went back to the owner's office. This guy was a real estate investor. So he bought properties just to flip them. How he got this from the state, I have no idea. So we're sitting down there in front of him. And he said, what'd Jimmy say? He says, we'll close Friday. He says, not without $35,000 down, you won't. And I'm thinking, what?
I've never given that before.
Yeah, I said, I've given you only $200 to my name. I said, where? He says, I know. And he picks the phone up right in front of us. Mr. So-and-so, I got Mr. and Mrs. Amber here. They want to buy the property on Price Road, but click. He said, I got your down payment. He said, you're going to need $5,000 to close. He says, $1,500 of that is for a survey because I just sold 5 acres off the back of that piece. It was originally 65 acres, actually. And then when he sold the 5 acres, it became 60 acres. Who was I to argue? I was in no position to negotiate, right?
So I mean, says, were you just not still in shock about what was taking place and wondering how real this was?
This was surreal. I thought I was dreaming this. And he says, so you're going to need $3,500. And if you don't have $3,500, he says, $1,500 for a survey. You pay me when you get it. You know, and for the next, I think it was like 7 years, $20 one month, $70 next month, $40 until it was paid off. He said, but if you don't come to closing with $3,500, he says, I have 5 people standing in line to buy that property and two of them have cash. And I'm thinking, okay, this is the classic age old sales gimmick, right? I met the two guys with the cash. They're scratching their head. How did this rich Yankee, get this property out from underneath me? Well, rich Yankee, we had nothing.
Right.
I mean, literally, not figuratively, nothing. That $200 that I gave that guy was $200 we had set aside in our school account to pay our school bill. We didn't even know how we were going to feed the kids. So this time we go back to campus, and now money's coming out of the woodwork. You got kids giving us money. My wife's boss said, I got $1,500 that if I can get back by September, I'm saving for a heating system. I'll give that to you. If you can get back to me, she says, of course. One of our babysitters that allowed Beth and I to go out on our date nights, on Fridays or Saturdays. She says, she's 19 years old and was just going to get married. She says, I love your little mobile home. She says, can we buy it? That was $2,000. Well, long story short, we came to closing with $3,500.
Wow.
And
in a week?
Actually, it ended up stretching out to almost a month.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It was things. It's read it all about it in the book. I'm trying to give you the condensed version here.
Absolutely.
But it actually did drag out to about a month. And when we went to closing, we left that place with almost enough money to buy lunch. It was the last day of our kids' school year. So we picked them up at school. They left that mobile home in the morning and we took them back to an old farmhouse that had no running water, no electricity, no washer, no dryer, no stove, no refrigerator, no bathroom, no central heat.
I mean, your kids must have thought you were crazy.
Everyone thought we were crazy. The people that we were that we went to church with thought we were crazy. The one guy who's on our board right now said, "Trace, this is the worst decision you ever made in your life." He lived right next to me, but he's now on the board. He says, I can't endorse this." And again, long story short, it took us 7 years to get this house habitable. It was an adventure. I would say that today, by today's standards, people could have turned us into Department of Children and Family Services and say, this is not a suitable way to do life. But the next 7 years was just a series of crazy stuff that really helped build our character and convince
kids that experience. My gosh.
Including the a birth of our fourth child, a daughter.
Oh, wow.
And the birth and 10 months of a major physical battle to keep our fifth child alive. We lost that battle. Mm. He was buried at the foot of the cross on Shepherd's Hill, the very spot that we used to pray to receive this property. So when we were praying to receive this property, we could have never imagined that we'd be burying a child under our feet right there. But that old cedar tree had blown down in a storm, and I took the wood and made a cross out of it and erected it there. But it wasn't the original cross. That came later. We had a cross that I would go to every night to seek the Lord's will for what exactly we were doing. And what he wanted us to do was to have kids live at Shepherd's Hill, which is the very thing that I refused to do. And I refused to do it because I didn't think I could love kids unconditionally enough to have them live in my yard.
Wow.
And when God allowed the circumstances of our son, Asa, his name is Asa, to take place and to bring us through all that, we learned so much. And the one thing we learned was that we could love unconditionally, because he was born with some issues that required us to love unconditionally. We were traveling 200 miles a day, round trip to Atlanta, just to be with him, to try to keep him alive. And that story is, there's much more to that story. But when we finally realized that God was really wanting us to have kids live at Shepherd's Hill, we moved out of the farmhouse. And the farmhouse, it took us 7 years to get it rehabbed and where it looks like a place someone would want to live in. And then God says, move out of it. It made no sense. We refinanced the farm, bought a double-wide mobile home, moved it out on Shepherd's Hill, not because our son's buried out there, but because it has the best view, a beautiful view of the Blue Ridge Mountains. And that house stood empty for 2 months. People wanted to rent it. We did parenting classes in there. We did all kinds of, you know, ministerial-type things in that building. But for the most part, it stayed empty. And I remember going in that empty house, just wrestling before God as to, why are you doing this to us? I mean, he wasn't doing it to us. He was doing it for us. And that's what a lot of people don't understand about how God works. How else is he going to get our attention unless he drags us through the mire? Well, we never look up when things are going well. We look up when things are going bad, right? Or what we think is bad.
Right.
So I may have never been closer to the God of the universe than in that particular time. And I remember being so confident in what God told me that I took the 150-foot walk over to the new mobile home, sat my kids around the dinner table, which we weren't eating dinner, sat my wife down, and I said to him, God has spoken to me, and I'm sitting here guaranteeing you what's going to happen. I said, I want you to remember this time, remember this date. If you'll remind Dad, I was talking to my kids, and Mom, to praise God and to thank him for all that he's allowing us to go through at this time. And there was much more beyond the death of our son going on. And I said, I'm telling you that in a few days, a week, but no longer than a month, this ministry is going to be blessed. We as a family are going to be blessed, but we're going to find out why we're here. Because for 7 years, we wrestled with why are we here? I mean, we were doing day camps, weekend camps.
So the name of Shepherd's Hill still hadn't been born yet.
Well, it was right about this time where it was actually born. And the narrow way I ran back then, maybe a little bit too harsh and politically incorrect. And my wife's Shepherd's Hill Academy was the softer touch that probably needed to be given. But I sat them down and they said, okay, we'll praise God. We'll thank him for all this suffering we're going through. And we'll expect something within a few days, maybe a month. And so we did. We committed to praising God and thanking Him for it all, in eager expectation. And I got a phone call about a little over a week later from a school in Atlanta. And they said, "We heard what you're doing up there with equine therapy and your ropes course stuff and your day camp stuff. Would you consider having kids actually live there?" And I just froze. And I said, "I don't know, you know, exactly how you found out about us, but you're the call I've been waiting for." And he came up. Now, you have to keep in mind that we bought this farm on a 15-year note. We were leveraged to the hilt. You know, we piled the down payment. We borrowed money for, you know,
everything.
Everything. Yeah. Even the survey. So every month was a new miracle for those first 7 years. And he comes up. There's a guy named Jim, and he was headmaster of a school in Atlanta, He looked around, and we had virtually nothing but grass and a couple outbuildings, and there was an old rickety barn. And other than the old empty house, we really had nothing. And he said, "Okay, I'll pay you a salary." He told us what it was. He said, "I'll pay your wife a salary." He told us what it was. And I thought, okay, that's a good deal, you know. And then he said, "How much is your farm payment?" And I told him. And he said, "Well, we'll pay that too." And I'm thinking, I just died and went to heaven. Overnight, I went from a full-time roofer to a part-time minister to a full-time minister to a part-time roofer overnight. And the first group of boys that come to the door at Shepherd's Hill, it wasn't I'd be lying if I said it was the first boy, it was the second boy. My son's name was Asa, and this boy's name was Asa. And I thought to myself, that's not Bill or George or Frank or, you know, it's like Asa.
It's an unusual name, right?
I took it as a confirmation. And again, there were so many things like that took place that I won't, you know, won't have time to go through right now. But that was the start of Shepherd's Hill. And then we realized that even back then around 2001, when digital technology wasn't to the level it is today, but people were still, you know, pretty addicted to their technology. The smartphones were still, you know, nearly a decade away. And we realized that it was important to get these kids back into nature, to work with their hands, feet, and back.
And you had all this property.
And we had all this property to work with. But over a series of next several years, we acquired so many additional parcels of property because here's what happened. We got a note from the Georgia Department of Transportation. Actually, we didn't get a note. We saw it in the front page of the local newspaper that they wanted to put a 4-lane highway through the middle of everything that we had built for 7 years. I can't tell you how debilitating that was. That was one of the other things that we were going through during that time when I set my kids down around the table, is that we were going to lose the farm. And the Lord just told us, build anyway. And we did. And that ended up being an 18-year battle. It started in 1999 is when that started. When we first saw the newspaper article. And then we started getting, you know, formal letters and things like that. Well, this was going right through the center, excuse me, of everything that we had built at that point. It had separated us from the boys and girls camp, from our ropes course facility, from our soccer field that we had built. And so this was an incredible battle that we had to fight for preservation. And we had to acquire 7 different tracts of land over a period of several years, all, you know, contiguous, stuck together to where now we have 250 acres of property to minister to our kids. But we never had to shut down for a day.
So the road went in and you just had to go in a different direction.
All the details are in the book, but it took 3 years before they started breaking ground and then traffic started. But we had to move our campsites a number of different times, just staying ahead of the construction and then staying ahead of the actual traffic. And these different parcels of land kept coming in at different times. And it's a funny thing, because one of the parcels of property that we purchased, it took 5 miles to get to. We thought all of Shepherd's Hill would have to go there. And as I looked out on a map, on an overhead aerial map, I realized it was only about 150 yards from our campus.
Oh,
because one of the first properties that we acquired came from our neighbor who said, you know that 20 acres I have across the street from you? He says, I bought that for my kids to ride horses. They're not going to ride horses. You want to? I'll give it to you just what I paid for it, which is really a fraction of prices were going way up, and it was a fraction of the price. And I said, sold. And so we refinanced the farm, got that. And every tract of property that we had acquired came from a refinance. But we had this donut hole, this meat in the sandwich piece of property that if we could acquire that property would connect us 1.5 miles off of that highway. It was like God perfectly orchestrated it. But at this point, it wasn't available. So we thought everything's going to go on this 70-acre track that I had discovered, which is 5 miles around, and only later to discover isn't all that far away from. I mean, I'd never been through there. It's just trees and over the river and through the woods and all that stuff. And as I was out there scouting around, long story short, and a ton of miracles later. That's why the title of the book is called "The Miracles of Shepherd's Hill." Not because of the miraculous life changes, and there are tons of those.
There were a lot of miracles.
But the miracles, circumstantial miracles that we could have never have orchestrated on our own, just to stay open. And as I was out there scouting on a campsite, which is currently our boys' site, I ended up getting lost in the woods. I ended up on a neighbor's property in a pasture, and he happened to be there. And he said, "What are you doing on my property?" I told him, and he says, "Oh, you're with Shepherd's Hill." I says, "Yeah, I heard of that. I heard you guys are doing good work there." He says, "How many different properties does Shepherd's Hill have now?" And I told him, and I thought the guy saw a ghost. He's like, "You own that. I said, "Yeah." I said, "We've just been refinancing, you know. We're trying to, this highway thing is really, it's been a thorn in our side now for, I forget how many years at that time, but close to 18. And he says, "Do you realize that you own every tract of land that Billy Moseley bought with cash to launder his drug money?"
Oh my gosh.
"Working for the devil and could not keep." Because he was one of the guys that died in that triple murder suicide thing. He says, "And now you're using all of it
to advance
the kingdom of God."
Right.
I said, "Yeah, first of all, I was shocked to hear that." And then I said, "Yeah, and you're not going to believe this." I said, "But I've got $200 in all of it." I said, "All I've been doing is refinancing. It's not the Dave Ramsey way, but to this right now, it's all paid for. It's all paid for. And it came because we were just diligent in doing what we knew to do. I shouldn't say it's all paid for, because the latest 50-acre track is not paid for. We did refinance a little bit to get that, but the rest of it's paid for. And so now we've got 250 acres. We have a big building project for a campus and a conference center, because we want to serve more people who cannot afford residential care, where they can come and learn how to raise their kids in a healthy manner. We've gotten so far away from the fundamentals of raising kids. We've bought into so many false premises and therefore false narratives about how to raise kids. Everything is backwards. It's just, it's insane. And so what I've discovered over the years is that, half of mental health, maybe 90% of mental health, is just knowing the truth and living by it. Objective reality.
People know who Shepherd's Hill serves. Who are the kids that come to you, and the parents who call you and need your assistance? What are the ages of the kids that you're working with, and what all do you provide there?
Yeah, well, we have a fully accredited junior and senior high school, so we're serving kids 13 to 17. There are some kids that are age 12 when they first get here.
Okay.
And there are tons that are 18 who are here until graduation, which is a year minimum. Most kids will get out of here in a year, but very often it goes according to the calendar. They could be here 14 months or 15 months or sometimes 11 months. But a year, we try to make it a year minimum. But that's the demographic. They come from virtually every state in the union. And we've had kids from 19 other countries that have come here to live in our woods, and where they're unplugged from digital technology for an entire year. Now, they make it a little bit on their computer screens in their schools and class, but they have no running water, no electricity in the cabins that they have, that they build down into the woods, and they're right on streams where there's little waterfalls they can hear. It's very therapeutic. They're in the woods. And so they come out of the woods every morning, about 6:30 every morning to go to school, go into the shower houses to get, you know, do their morning clean up for breakfast, take care of their hygienic needs, change into their school clothes, go to school, 8 hours of school like any other, well, actually more than any other school today, because so many schools today are getting away from the 3 hours. But there are a lot of specialty classes, and some kids require an online class, maybe something we don't offer for that particular semester. And so that's why
you have teachers there that are teaching these
real teachers. It's a 5-to-1 ratio with a teacher's assistant. Okay. So one teacher has 5 students and a teacher's assistant. So if a student needs to get on the computer, of course it's all filtered and all that stuff, which that doesn't mean a thing because kids can get around that. But there's a human set of eyes behind them. We've learned that when kids are stimulated with good and healthy things for an entire year, they start acquiring appetites for good and healthy things. But they first have to know what good and healthy things are. And right. That has been so watered down basically since the 1960s when postmodern thought and relativism came onto the equation. Now we think, well, your truth is as good as my truth. There are no absolute standards of moral right and wrong. And we've totally diluted things to the point where even the people with a lot of letters behind their name can't agree on what is actually the right way to approach this or that concerning mental health and spiritual health. That's not even much of a conversation anymore. But, you know, our kids come to understand that we are not primarily human beings who occasionally have human experiences. We are fundamentally spiritual beings having a human experience. And when we see it that way, then the proper foundations are built. And when you build on a false foundation, then the false narrative follows, and who knows where it goes from there. So we're building on a firm foundation, what all of American history basically followed, tradition, you know, for the last several thousand years, the Judeo-Christian ethic. And it's worked pretty good for most parents down through history. It's only in recent years that we've gotten away from it, and we've suffered for it. We've had so many new maladies, or, you know, ADD, ADHD, ODD,
the mental health aspects have just exploded.
We call it AT, a lot, not all of it, because there are some legitimate mental health issues, but ATD, American Teenager Disorder, right? Entitled, narcissistic, you know, the whole world revolves around them, and parents are complicit.
The kids didn't get that way by themselves.
They didn't. My generation is responsible for that. You're probably part of my generation, and, you know, we bucked from what was working pretty well up until that point. And that's why I like what G.K. Chesterton said. He said, you know, before you tear down a fence, find out why it was put up to begin with, right? And so we've torn down a lot of fences as adults that know more than God now. And now the hippie generation, their kids, grandkids, and even great-grandkids are not just, you know, in leadership, they're calling the shots in Washington and in all the higher political realms of every industry, whether it's digital technology, Washington politics, mental health. And that postmodern thought has crept into even, you know, the Christian church, and it's diluted it to the point where there's some very, very warped ideologies coming out of it. And our kids are living in a time where they don't know who or what to believe anymore.
So how do you work with the parents while the kids are there so that you're not just healing the children, you're also having the parents be a part of the process?
Regular conversations like this, this is where digital technology becomes a tool rather than a weapon, right? So we can talk to a kid from France, kid's parents from France or you know, somewhere in Africa or California or just down the street, just like we're doing right now. Right. Our therapeutic team works with them. We just finished up our biannual parent weekends where, you know, it's just incredibly enlightening when these kids and parents get together, as parents flock from all over the world to get here. I'll run them through a lot of ropes course and equine therapy activities, interactive things, challenging them, understanding that just because Junior's smiling doesn't mean you're succeeding. There comes a time when iron sharpens iron, and you've got to really get down to some very ugly, dirty, tough business. And we're not afraid of that. And I think that's what people appreciate about us, is that we don't shy away from things. We do understand that just because Junior is smiling, that doesn't mean, that's not a measure of our success as a parent, nor is it a measure of success as to whether he's making progress toward healing. Because, you know, there is a time, Dory, when it is plenty okay to not feel so good about yourself, to be depressed even. I mean, if I go to my, and I did, I went to my son's funeral. I wasn't happy about it, right? It's my son's funeral. I'm not happy. I'm very, very sad about that. But I never lost my joy. And I think we've conflated happiness with joy. You know, happiness is contingent upon happenings. As long as Junior's got his smartphone, or as long as Junior's got his sex, drugs, or rock and roll, he's smiling. He's happy. Well, there are a lot of happy drunks. There are a lot of happy pimps.
Yes, there are.
And they're very happy being that way. There are a lot of happy pimps, perverts, and prostitutes, and people living on the street in their tents in L.A. and New York and other places around the country,
yep,
Seattle.
Yep, Colorado as well. Yeah.
Yes. But is it right? You know, we've accepted the abnormal. We've accepted the unhealthy. You know, I tell our kids and our parents all the time, you know, is it normal for an alcoholic to be drunk? Well, yeah, it's normal for an alcoholic to be drunk. But is it normal to be alcoholic, right?
Well, I want to make sure, Terry, before we run out of time, that people know how to find out more about Shepherd's Hill Academy, how to get to your website, what phone number to call for more information.
Sure.
And I want to make sure we get the name of the book again so we can look forward to that coming out. Please let me know, you know, when that comes out. I'll make sure we get that listed on the website as well for people. It's going to be a fascinating story. But what's the best way for people to get in touch and learn more about Shepherd's Hill, especially if they have an adolescent that they're concerned about?
Sure. Well, any parent can go to shepherdshillacademy.org. The easiest thing to remember is helpmytroubledteen.org. Helpmytroubledteen.org. It'll take you right to our website. But I really can't stress enough. We just got nominated for the National Religious Broadcasters Program of the Year this year with our radio program, Licensed to Parent.
Yes.
We go into I will call it blue collar. We try to stay away from the psychobabble so that most common parent can understand what we're talking about. And it makes sense to them. It's all scientifically backed. It's all scripturally sound, but it's all scientifically backed.
And I'll make sure that link is on the page too for parents who want to tune in and listen to your radio show, because you really have a lot to offer.
And it's licensedtoparent.org, licensedtoparent.org, and they go to our archives to hear our 30-minute weekly program where we talk to all the top minds around the world about this subject of raising up kids, and secular and Christian kids. Science is science. All truth is God's truth, right? I don't care who comes with it. The devil tells me 2 + 2 = 4, and Jesus himself says 2 + 2 = 5. I'm siding with the devil on this one, because 2 + 2 = 4.
So much that you shared with us today, Trace. I mean, I just really appreciate the journey that you've taken, everything that you've put into what you've built and are still building. You know, amazing family, amazing miracles that have taken place to bring this all together. And it's still continuing.
It's another book. There's another book in what's taken place since this book has been finished. You're right. It is continuing. And it'll be an ever-evolving deal as my kids take it over and other people take it over, because I'm in the twilight years. Not that I'll ever retire, but... you know, time.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I'd welcome you back anytime.
Well, thank you.
There's endless stories for you to share about everything that you've been through and what you're doing. And I value everything that you're sharing.
Well, you're kind to say that. I do appreciate that. And thank you for what you're doing too, because this is a team effort. We're all on the same team pulling together.
Thank you. I want to let our listeners know that next week our guest is going to be Tracy Markle, and she is the founder and co-director of Digital Media, She's going to be talking about the five types of digital media overuse. And that definitely is an ongoing topic of interest as well. But my saying for today kind of fits into a little bit about what Trace just shared. It's, if you have a friend who is going through any kind of difficult time, help them by making sure you maintain your own joy. Your good feelings will help lift them, but joy is the key. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Every voice matters. See you next week, Thursday, 12 noon. Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.